Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Always nice to be able to share this hour with you. This is going to be a really deep diving discussion. As bad as COVID is, and it is, as many lives as it's taken, it has, as serious as we should take it, we have taken it. But now you're going to see where this is going. This is only the beginning. Behind this are efforts at a reset. You might have heard the word reset. What does it mean? It means that a relatively small group of individuals headed by the high-tech companies intend to put us into a virtual prison, not physically, but through our ability to get all reality coming from them. And yes, there will be limitations. For example, they'll get rid of all currencies except digital currency. They control it. They'll be able to give medical attention through a computer with devices that you see or wear or ingest. They'll control all mandated vaccines. In fact, they'll control everything. There will be no dissent allowed. Who says? Well, we've been reviewing this very carefully. Those of you who watched and listened to the Corbett Report know that last night we did an entire segment on it. I will continue that next week with a different person who is extremely articulate and very knowledgeable. You won't want to miss Whitney Webb from Chile. She'll be on next Tuesday night for an hour. We're going to show you who's behind the scenes controlling all this. In any case, today we have two individuals that will represent the second part of our program, one for about 13 minutes, one for 15 minutes. What they're going to be telling you is absolutely accurate. It has all been vetted. But here's what will surprise you. These are not scientists, PhDs, MDs. These are not investigative journalists. These are both mothers with children who became concerned about what they saw and become extraordinarily educated. As you will hear, you won't hear a scientist who knows as much about what they're saying as they do. So this is to get you aware that behind COVID and due to COVID, there's now the big move to speed up how much of society they're going to be able to control. Who voted them into office to give them control over our lives? No one. But a lot of the people in office, both on the left and right, are supporting them because they in turn are rewarded. So that's a part of our show. Also today, I'll be doing the investigative report showing you the flawed blind spots in calculating COVID-19 deaths. And this should really make you concerned that the figures you're getting every day in the New York Times, they're wrong. For example, you'll keep seeing spike in COVID positives or COVID. You would think if you're the average person, that means people are having the virus and spreading it or sick. That's not the case. These are just people that tested, but the test itself is flawed, and it could be the person had a cold 10 years ago or 10 months ago. The virus is no longer in their body, but an antibody is, and it's recording that. They're playing with the figures. We're going to challenge them on that today. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. One of the questions I'm asked all the time is, what can I do to improve my vascular health? And optimal heart health depends upon many different conditions and factors. For example, lowering your homocysteine level. Well, that's easy. A vitamin B complex, not even a high potency one, 25 milligrams, can lower that because it's got B6 in there, folic acid in there, or folate, which helps reduce, along with vitamin C and B12, your homocysteine level. That's the silent killer. Because you can seem completely healthy. You could be an Olympic athlete, have elevated homocysteine, drop dead of a heart attack. So getting that down is easy. Here's the trouble. When you take aspirin for thinning of the blood, instead of a natural substance that could thin it much easier and safer, like vitamin C, green juices, green vegetables, vitamin E, all are natural blood thinners. But aspirin does something different. It destroys vitamin C in the B complex, and as a result, those who take the aspirin are going to have a higher homocysteine level, which also means when you get up around 12, 13, 14, 15 in your numbers, you're at high risk of a heart attack or stroke. You can also do more exercise, do more rigorous exercise. That also helps. But then you can eat a plant-based diet, and that's the biggest thing of all. If I had to say, what is the one thing we could all do to improve our heart health? A healthy, clean, plant-based diet, wherever possible, organic and locally grown. Because the further away from you it is grown, the longer it takes to get to you, the likelihood is they're going to pick it immature. They might pick it a week or 2 weeks before it really is ripe. We see that all the time with tomatoes that have no taste. In fact, a lot of vegetables and fruits have no taste. Peaches that are pithy and not sweet, not juicy. That's because they're not allowed to ripen on the vine. And so they ripen in transit, sometimes artificially with gases that are sprayed on them. So a clean diet grown locally supports local economy, lowers the carbon footprint, and is, when you're a vegan, it's the one thing all of us could do that we don't have to wait on the corruption of government working with industry that is corrupt at both the local level, state level, and the federal level. Because nothing's going to happen environmentally. We know that. If it was going to happen, it would happen. We keep talking about the environment, using it as a ploy to get votes if you're a politician. But when was the last time someone said, as of today, we're going to boycott Congress. We're going to have a strike. All legislators are going to wait outside until we agree to immediately start planting 1 billion trees this year, hiring people in local communities, giving them a living wage, not minimum wage, so that they can plant the trees. Why? Because the carbon that is captured in the trees, sequestered in the trees, is one thing that can help lower global warming. Also, we can stop buying so much stuff, and we can stop eating animals. So all these things you have under your control if you demand it. And if a legislator is not willing to put their job on the line for a higher purpose, saving the planet, saving the people on the planet, then why in the world would you trust anything they say or vote for them? It makes no sense. So that's something you can do that also helps your heart. Then there's some supplements that are known to help your heart and your arteries, especially the endothelium, the lining of your arteries, pomegranate. Pomegranate has what are called polyphenols, and these are scientifically proven to support healthy blood flow. So the more pomegranate juice that you drink or concentrate or eating pomegranates, the healthier your arteries, the thinner your blood. There's also a substance called SOD. S is for super, O for oxide, D for dismutase, superoxide dismutase. It supports arterial function and boosts the body's protective enzymes. It's really good for you. It also increases nitric oxide. Nitric, N-I-T-R-I-C, oxide, and that improves vascular health and gives your arteries a chance to heal, your heart a chance to get more blood and oxygen. And then there's something else you might not have known about. It's called sweet orange peel. Now, that supports nitric oxide production for healthy circulation, and it's really good. So sweet orange peel extract, superoxide dismutase, and pomegranate complex. So if we wanted to help, and I'm not getting into the exotic now, like coenzyme Q10, I'm just telling an easy way to do something that's inexpensive, and it's right in front of us, it's available, it's not a drug, there's no side effects, and it can only make us healthier. Also, there's a new study that is interesting because it shows that one of the reasons a lot of people suffer from postpartum depression, and it's because they're deficient in vitamin D3. This was from the Institute of Postgraduate Medical Education and Research in India. And they studied all these different individuals and found that the 25-hydroxo of vitamin D, the levels in women with postpartum depression symptoms was very low. So if you're pregnant, get up your vitamin D level. It's safe and it's important. Also, there's a study out of University of Turin in Italy. Kind of interesting. because it shows you the appreciation of beauty can foster perceptual learning. That seems a little complicated. What do I mean? It means stopping and seeing are crucial components of many types of meditative practices, including Buddhist Zen meditation. And in fact, these practices typically entail ceasing all activities to observe the thoughts, the feelings, and sensations arising at any given time. Now, mind you, this is because we get an average of 55,000 thoughts per day. Some are going to go through your mind very quickly. Others become obsessive, especially if you've got problems in a relationship or economics or health. And especially at this time in COVID, where people have been locked down, and now we're told that another lockdown is possible. And just remember, I'll tell you how you're being played again. The CDC just announced that it's no longer counting deaths from the flu or pneumonia or influenza. Well, that means that those deaths are almost absolutely certain to go on to the COVID-19 death count. Therefore, they could justify the so-called second wave. Because right now, according to the statistics I have, COVID-19 and the normal flu, or even a severe flu, are about the same. But if you notice in some countries like Canada, they had 14 cases of flu this year compared to, 33,000, and last year, and then 45,000, 55,000 year before. Well, you can't go from tens of thousands to 14 or 15 unless you've simply taken the flu deaths and associated them with COVID. So this is how we're being played. In any case, all these thoughts are going through our mind, and any sound, any smell will stimulate our sensory stimuli from our surrounding environment. Now, some of these are very pleasant. I know that I cut the grass, and when I cut the grass, I love the smell of fresh cut grass. And at nighttime, when I walk around, I've got night bloomers, lavender, lilac, honeysuckle, and jasmine, and it just fills the air, and it's very soothing, very relaxing. Well, in Buddhist meditation, stopping and seeing essentially refers to the process of not engaging in cravings or delusions of the mind and seeing the truth, meaning perceiving things exactly as they are without interpreting them or trying to change them. Combined, these two concepts summarize the ancient belief and philosophical notion that action and inhibition and observation of attunement with sensory stimuli can enhance awareness and appreciation, helping to establish a spiritual connection with our surroundings. But let me make it even simpler. Yes, wouldn't it be nice if we could all take a stroll in breathtaking natural venues, a sunset, a waterfall, a rainbow, stars in the night sky, looking at creative artwork, a painting, being inspired by someone reading one of Rumi's poems, watching a movie, or any other phenomena. That finds us aesthetically pleasing. In other words, beauty appears to encourage us to stop and embrace the present moment. Watching puppies play and cats play, watching anything that's young and innocent playing and enjoying their environment without thought, that we all enjoy that. Puts a smile on our face. Hearing the right music does the same. It transports us to a place of ease, especially when there's so much dis-ease. But mind you, when you see something for what it is, that's what it is. And if you leave it at that, then when you hear all the reporters on the network news all saying the same things, using the same talking points, then you know it's not independently derived information. It's biased information that is acting like propaganda. So fine. You don't get angry about it. You simply say, I can't trust that. If, for example, last night on Tucker Carlson, they spent an entire hour, first time in their history, on one topic, having a man who is the partner of the hunter and his brother and his father, who's running for president, probably be elected, and his brother. And this man was brought in to take care of the family by being president of a new corporation. And he just told what it was. He had met repeatedly with Joe Biden, met all the time with Hunter Biden, and this was with a lot of companies in different countries, including China. So he just told the truth as he knew it, and now we can either accept that and the facts. Everything he said, by the way, is fully documented from emails coming to him from all the Bidens. Or we can be like all the other media and say it's a Russian conspiracy, which it isn't. But at least knowing that, I know who not to trust, the mainstream media. When a scientist attacks my guest yesterday as a quack because he did a study with vitamin C and zinc and a hormone that was able to save not just one sepsis patient, but 1,500 of them, and has the highest success rate with sepsis of any doctor in the world, then he's a 400 articles in peer-reviewed journal. He's a distinguished professor. He is board certified. He's never had a controversy in his entire 30-year career. And now he's being attacked. So he stood up and he fought back. And I had to tell him, you're not the first person to be attacked. So when you look at the people attacking him, I ask a simple question. Did any of these people before they attacked you on the internet and tried to destroy your reputation, which has been impeccable, did anyone call you or email you saying, could you send me more details? Can you send me the peer review article you published on how you stopped one of the leading killers in America? It's right up there with diabetes, actually exceeds diabetes, and that's sepsis. And no, not a single person. So all the other peers out there, your medical doctor, colleagues, and scientists, they didn't want to know your truth. They wanted to demean you from your truth. Yes. Well, how objective is a person that condemns you without looking at any evidence? You walk in a courtroom and they say, death, death of your career, death of your reputation. Why? Don't you want to know my... No, we don't care about the truth. We don't care about your evidence. But you're the ones whose patients are dying, not mine. We could save 6 to 10 million people a year from sepsis death around the world. Don't you want to know? No, we don't want to know because we're right and we don't have to prove it because we're a cabal. So that's one of the things you do when you see something for what it is. You just stop and say, that's what it is. And then independently confirm that. So that gets back to stopping and seeing. Why can't we as a nation stop and see that all politicians lie? They all are compromised, and many of them are sociopaths. But we won't, because no matter what we stop and see with our own eyes, we'll convince ourselves that because of ideological association or because of political association or because of financial interest, we're willing to overlook everything that's in the dark side of their being, and believe in some fantasy that they have a higher calling to help us. They don't. They help themselves. So that's one more way that Buddhist meditation and stopping and seeing engages in the truth. And that can also be very relaxing. We're 19 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'm going to share with you why you should be very concerned about everything that you've heard up to this point about how this pandemic has to go into another lockdown, and now they want to make wearing masks mandatory for the next 2 years. And I'm saying, this is nonsense. We've got to look for the truth, and we're not looking for the truth. We'll share that with you in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This article was posted on PRN.fm, and Jesse and John in our PRN studios in New York have posted how you can watch the videos that we'll be showing you in real time. Some people had a little difficulty finding them and or getting to them, so they've put up there exactly how you can do it. So in about 10 minutes from now, when we go to two videos back to back, you'll be able to watch them in real time. This article is entitled "The Flawed Blind Spots in Calculating COVID-19 Deaths." And in our new coronavirus world, there still remain signs of hope, although infection rates are rising in rural America and in some European nations, deaths have declined substantially, and especially in the United States, but also look in South Korea, look in Taiwan, look in Sweden. My goodness, There's a good news story. However, the international emphasis is now single-minded towards developing a vaccine as soon as possible under the assumption that it will protect its recipients from acquiring symptoms of illness. There remain many controversies over whether or not such a vaccine will be effective. Dr. Peter Doshi, associate editor of the British Medical Journal, one of the most respected medical journals in the world, recently published an article stating an observation that will surely upset vaccine advocates and Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates. Quote, listen carefully, please. None of the trials currently underway are designed to detect a reduction in any serious outcome, such as hospitalizations, intensive care use, deaths, nor are the vaccines being studied to determine whether they can interrupt transmission of the virus, end quote. Now, please allow his statement to sink in for a moment. In other words, based upon the trials underway, whether these vaccines will protect you or others is completely unknown. In fact, they're not even testing for it. Let me repeat this. Quote, none of the trials currently underway are designed to detect a reduction in any serious outcome, such as hospitalizations, intensive care use, deaths, nor are the vaccines being studied to determine whether they can interrupt transmission of the virus. Well, then what good are they? That's the whole purpose, but not their purpose. In the meantime, the New York Times, Washington Post, and major networks continue to fuel our national panic, fear-mongering, by reminding us that a second wave is forthcoming and we must constantly be aware of COVID-19 lethality. Thus, we must social distance, engage in hygiene and other measures, wear masks to protect ourselves. Okay, I'm for that. I'm for social distancing. I'm really for hygiene, washing surfaces areas with alcohol, washing our hands, wearing gloves. And masks are pro and con. There's science supporting them. There's science challenging it. But what you should do is you should do what you feel is in your best interest. But something remains very puzzling. Does the average person truly understand or know how to decipher the statistics that health officials and the media feed us on a daily basis? For example, we hear repeatedly that more and more people are being diagnosed with COVID. However, actual deaths have leveled off substantially despite rising case numbers. Deaths are in no way similar to the large March and April spikes when far fewer people were being tested. There is also a growing number of scientists and physicians challenging these statistics and questioning the methods by which they are being tabulated. The standard PCR test, the most relied upon diagnostic tool, is non-specific for detecting the COVID-19 strain. Other tests are terribly inaccurate. You may have had a small cold from one or of many coronavirus strains months ago and still test PCR positive and be ruled as having contracted COVID-19. Of course, the more tests performed will result in an increase in positive outcomes, especially among those who are asymptomatic or mildly so, or may have contracted it in the past but are no longer infected. If everyone were tested for the herpes virus, for example, we would have a widespread pandemic, and in fact, it would dwarf COVID-19 by the mere policy of widespread testing. But PCR was never intended for clinical use or diagnostics. The figures being broadcast, therefore, do not represent reliable data to conclude if there is a real present danger. But for people, if they test positive, even with a grossly inaccurate test, they will believe that they are infected and could develop full-blown symptoms and die. Indeed, for a much smaller segment of people with comorbidities, this is true, just as it is for the flu and other infectious respiratory illnesses. But COVID does not have the same impact on babies, toddlers, youngsters, teenagers, and young people, as the flu does. We decided to investigate the disparate and contradictory figures being touted to try to determine what people are actually dying from. Is it COVID, as we're told, other respiratory illnesses like pneumonia, or pre-existing comorbidities along with the virus. And during the first 6 months of the pandemic, overall deaths were being almost exclusively attributed to COVID-19 and did not indicate other possible or even more likely causes. Now that death certificates are being re-examined and re-evaluated, it raises an alarming question. The CDC has stated, quote, this is from the CDC, quote, for 6% of the deaths, COVID-19 was the only cause mentioned, end quote. So if a person, therefore, has end-stage congestive heart disease or end-stage cancer or end-stage diabetes, but tested COVID positive, does that mean the virus is the primary cause? Or is it a secondary or even tertiary? Now that the CDC, as well as other nations such as Italy, have officially stated that COVID-19 alone is responsible for far less deaths than previously reported, the entire pandemic scenario and wisdom behind lockdowns needs to be reevaluated. Stanford University's Dr. Johann Ioannis recently did a study in the bulletin published in the Bulletin of the World Health Organization, reviewed the available scientific studies and concluded there was no huge spike in deaths that can be attributed exclusively to COVID-19. One project estimated that about 500 million people have been infected, which is far greater than the 29 million documented by laboratory testing. Using these figures, the actual fatality rate, meaning death rate, is less than 0.2%. And as he stated, quote, may be brought even lower, end quote. The analysis debunks recent headlines that 300,000 Americans have died from COVID. That was in the New York Times. Let them justify it. They can't. Consequently, the pandemic is only based upon numerical calculations that have little relevance to the real biological cause. Indeed, the fatality rate may be much lower. Geneticist Dr. James Lynn Weiler has stated that, quote, numerous media reports attribute deaths from COVID-19 to, quote, underlying conditions, end quote, with one report claiming that 88% of deaths involving COVID-19 deaths were not caused by COVID-19, and another claiming that 99% of COVID deaths are not caused by the virus, end quote. There is a rising concern among federal health officials about the soaring rates in drug overdoses and suicides, which can be largely credited to the pandemic response. Anthony Fauci and others that took no concern for the socioeconomic fallout, the loss of jobs, the foreclosures, the family strife, depression, loss of health insurance and welfare benefits, and being confined indoors. Although there are no national statistics for drug overdose and suicide this year, 40 states have reported opiate and other drug fatalities higher than last year. In July, the CDC roughly estimated a 13% increase in deaths from ODs. Well, based upon the official 2019 death rates from ODs and suicides, this would account for 9,000 to 12,000 additional deaths this year. Fresno in California is reporting a 70% overdose increase since the start of the pandemic. Suicides among teens is skyrocketing. For every single teen suicide, there are now 200 attempts to kill themselves. In 2018, the rate was one successful suicide for every 30 attempts. We have never faced such a crisis in our history, but nobody is speaking about this scourge in the context of the draconian government efforts in the war against corona. Other protective measures to counter the virus, notably quarantines and isolation, are contributing to an increase in the severity of pre-existing illnesses and preventable deaths. Under normal circumstances, a patient with cancer or any other autoimmune disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, chronic respiratory illness, etc., would be visiting their physicians and going to the hospital and having needed surgeries when needed for proper standard care treatment. Those avenues have largely been shut down for millions of sick Americans. Instead, those with compromised immune systems are terrified to leave their homes in fear of contracting the virus. This is a very real and underreported crisis. In June, the New York Times published an article There has been an increase in other causes of death, not just coronavirus. The story reported a 10% increase in all causes of death, including a 15% rise in heart disease and diabetes, a 5% increase in influenza and respiratory deaths, and a 1% increase in Alzheimer's. Therefore, unlike previous years, more patients are now dying from a lack of medical attention from their traditional diseases. And we might add that Kaiser Permanente reported that states that 45% of all COVID deaths are patients with long-term care facilities such as nursing homes and hospice care. So they're dying of the disease that they had, that they would have died of, not COVID-19, but they have been unfortunately combined. This conflation is intentional deception. Yet this demographic makes up only 8% of total COVID cases. Why is there such glaring discrepancy? Clearly, we are miscalculating the causes of death horribly. Aside from pre-existing diseases that make these individuals more vulnerable to symptomatic infection, we must also acknowledge their efforts to halt the virus's spread and the Trump administration's dreadful economic response. It's tossed millions of Americans into even worse health conditions. More Americans are malnourished or undernourished due to the lack of food security than at any time in modern history. Mental depression and anxiety is rising. Stress is endemic. And these are all contributing to factors for lowered immunity and higher death rates, with or without COVID-19. A first-of-its-kind global study conducted by the Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, found that the lockdowns, quote, dramatically altered our personal habits, largely for the worse, end quote. The study noted an increase in greatly reduced exercise and physical movement, a decline in mental health and poor sleep quality. Both of those, poor sleep, reduced exercise, and a third, actually, the physical movement, are all contributing to a speeded up death. How much of these are contributing to a higher susceptibility to infections and worsening of symptoms? The federal response by both parties to curb these adverse effects from lockdowns and to protect those that are most vulnerable is abysmal. It's non-existent. It's draconian. It's like putting half of a nation into prisons. It's deplorable. It is now widely acknowledged that between last February and June, many of the actual deaths were not caused by COVID-19, but from pre-existing comorbidities or inappropriate medical interventions and therapies, such as the inappropriate use of ventilators and drugs, and a lack of preparedness in general primary care. Consequently, many errors in judgment were made. But in our opinion, the most egregious blunder was to base official health policy to tackle the pandemic on flawed mathematical modeling to determine the virus's virulence, circulation, and lethality. Sadly, seemingly no lessons have been learned from these far-reaching errors. As of October 22nd, the CDC website tracking COVID-19 statistics was reporting 208,600 deaths that in some way, end quote, involved the virus. Not proven, some way. But the number of pneumonia deaths with or without COVID stands at 213,800, and 94,800 deaths are being reported due to COVID with pneumonia. 79% of deaths assigned to COVID-19 are individuals aged 65 and older. If we compare the total number of deaths from all causes on a normal basis, and we went back 5-6 years, we compared worldwide death rates by country for 6 years, then this is no more than a very bad flu season. But think of the reputations that would be affected. Think of the lawsuits that would come, the class action suits, if anyone had to admit that they were wrong, and they were all wrong. Another anomalous statistic that is worrisome and has yet to be properly addressed is the conflation of actual flu and pneumonia-associated deaths with those being reported as COVID-19. Dr. Lyons Weller has documented that as both confirmed and assumed case COVID-19 decline, influenza cases are falling, meaning as more COVID deaths rise, pneumonia deaths, influenza deaths fall. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that they're combining people dying strictly of pneumonia or influenza with COVID-19. To add to the confusion, just as the CDC continues to tally COVID-19 deaths, it again converged influenza pneumonia deaths with COVID. Quote, only 8.1% of flu and pneumonia cases were bona fide flu cases. This same trend is now being observed with COVID. So the CDC claims approximately 34,000 people die from flu infections annually. However, no distinction is made between influenza and pneumonia deaths. They're two separate diseases. They're grouped together. They shouldn't be. It is an excellent propaganda strategy for keeping people nervous when flu season arrives in order to get rid of and distribute about 100 million plus vaccine doses and our tax dollars purchased every year. Now we discover the CDC recategorized influenza pneumonia cases as COVID-19. A Dr. Wodarg noted that it is, quote, well-known fact that in every flu wave, 7 to 15% of acute respiratory illness, ARIs, are coming along with coronavirus, end quote. He further warns, quote, we are currently not measuring the incidence of coronavirus disease, but the activity of the specialists searching for them. We still do not know COVID-19's pathogenetic role and impact compared to the common seasonal flu. So in conclusion, after we take a bird's eye view of our corona landscape and reflect on the official numbers and statistics, we must question the justification for the draconian efforts being undertaken to isolate the nation until a vaccine arrives. And as we have reported earlier, there is no certainty that a vaccine will have much effect in reducing infection rates. An equally large problem is that the mainstream media, with all of its talent and fact-checking capabilities, should be able to recognize this terrain of statistical inconsistencies and report on it. Yet it has failed to do so. It raises the question whether any of our news outlets are there to educate the public or simply a wing of the CDC and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease Public Relations. In the meantime, more and more medical professionals are stepping forward and making efforts to challenge and refute the decisions being implemented by official policymakers. Interesting, historically, it was always those of us who were considered in the ultra position, meaning the ultra-left position, the progressive position, to challenge the corruption within the mainstream liberal community, like Obama's and Hillary Clinton's government, or Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton's government, or other George Bush's. But now, it is not our voices that are front and center. It's the mainstream scientists, mainstream physicians who are coming forward by the tens of thousands with demonstrations all over the world, conferences all over the world, saying there's a lot about this that we got wrong and let's change it. So, and there is a determination there. So if Dr. Ioannidis' analysis of available studies is accurate and 500 million people have now been exposed or contracted the virus and the actual number of deaths is 0.2%, then this is not a pandemic and none of the government's oppressive policies warrant the complete disruption of human life that threatens all of our future well-being. Now, just a few things to follow up on this. First, from the conversation, health insurers are starting to roll back coverage for telehealth, even though demand is way up. And, quote, in less than a year, telehealth has gone from a niche rarity to a common practice. Its ability to ensure physical distance, preserve personal protection, protective equipment, and prevent the spread of infection among healthcare workers and patients has been invaluable during the COVID-19 pandemic. As healthcare specialists and researchers, we have long seen the potential for telehealth, providing healthcare remotely with technology, which has been around for several decades. Despite evidence it could safely treat and manage a range of health conditions in a cost-effective manner, widespread adoption of the practice have been limited by issues including insurance coverage, restrictions on prescribing, and technology access. So now, they're pushing back. The insurance industry is pushing back. The whole health insurance industry is not supporting this. So something that was helping people, now it's challenged. And also, another thing that I'm looking at is there is an awful lot of conversation out there about Anthony Fauci's 40 years of lies, from AZT to remdesivir. And we're going to present all that information to you on an upcoming program. I think it's important that we know the truth. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear from one of the two individuals who are looking at where all this is going. Why would they want all these draconian measures? Why would they want to mandate the vaccines and then have Microsoft and Google work together to monitor a person every hour of every day, every second of every day, from a distance and collect data? And they know that they can collect the data from the nanoparticles, but what is the science that allows them to give you data that you may not even be aware that is going into your body? Why? Why are they doing all this? Why has Google claimed now that any information that challenges anything on COVID, you're being deplatformed on YouTube? You'll lose all your YouTube rights. You'll no longer be on YouTube because you challenge it. That's a freedom of speech. That's the basis of all the other freedoms of our Bill of Rights and Constitution guarantees. But it's happening. We'll hear from a person who has something to say on this right after our break.
Thanks so much for letting me be part of the conversation today. I prepared some remarks to read just so I can keep well under time, but I have a lot more information on my blog if folks want to look that up afterwards, and I'm looking forward to the larger discussion. So I'm talking about Davos. So we're speaking of elections, but also there are folks sort of behind the election. So that is my focus today, is what else is going on. We are living in tumultuous times with polarizing political theater and pandemic providing ample cover for the rollout of the fourth industrial revolution. From the World Economic Forum's outpost at San Francisco's Presidio, the tentacles of dispossession triggered by Klaus Schwab's Great Reset are rapidly encircling the globe. And we are witnessing the culmination of a century of machinations by Western social engineers. We are seeing predatory philanthropy use such euphemistic framing as living cities, healthy cities, resilient cities, and building back better to package the profoundly anti-human and anti-life activities coming out of Davos as aspirational goals for smart living. The oligarch class asks us to play along with them and overlook the fact that all of this smartness rests on a foundation of continued growth, fossil fuel expansion, child labor, toxic waste, and space pollution. They demand that we overlook the insatiable energy requirements needed to run the augmented reality Internet of Things illusion, and that we put out of our minds the existence of the vast data centers cooled 24/7 with the water of a thirsty and poisoned world. They've outdone themselves propagandizing youth to cheer on transnational global capital's plans to implement a final green solution. Though my hope is that after months of digital alienation, people's spirits will stir in time to derail the intentions of the cruel biocapitalist regime, ready to push us away from our rightful connections to natural systems and one another and into isolated virtual realms. The spell of faux ICT, individual communication technology sustainability must be broken. Predatory debt finance has gotten a spit and polish makeover, rebranded as circular economies and now stakeholder capitalism to make it more palatable. Post-COVID poverty mining enterprises will emerge from the ashes, and smart sensor networks, predictive policing, and public-private partnerships will latch onto shell-shocked families trying to pick up the pieces. And while Bitcoin-loving agorists dream of liberation on blockchain, central bankers have entirely different envisions, things in mind. They are conjuring a future of data flowing through digital wallets, fuel for an emergent social impact economy, one that has been carefully plotted out for third sector and now fourth sector implementation by social finance and Sir Ronald Cohen, Harvard Business School graduate and father of UK venture capital. So Bloomberg Philanthropies, a digital innovation project in the Global Parliament of Mayors based out of The Hague, will ensure that GovTech and open data platforms are ready to deliver all the data these markets need. Conveniently, a new operating system for government developed by Neil Kleiman of NYU's GovLab and Stephen Goldsmith of Harvard Kennedy School's Data Smart City Solutions will permit politicians of all stripes to deftly shift accountability for devastating policies onto faceless cadres of analysts. Data dashboards have proven effective weapons in swaying populations conditioned for compliance. It is difficult to effectively direct public sentiment against something as ephemeral as an algorithm. The war on terror has been swapped for pandemic preparedness, which could work out well for the World Bank's efforts to grow their vaccine and pandemic bond markets. Now we all pose threats to state security simply by living in a human body. Robot police dogs, drones, facial recognition cameras, wearable sensors, and biometric tracking are now framed as vital investments needed to keep communities safe in what is rapidly becoming a global open-air prison. Track and trace free-range humans. Look to industrial farming, look to wildlife management, look to Gaza, look to the Commons Project. Common Pass is not their only venture, not by a long shot. It is not just air travel that Rockefeller Foundation and the World Economic Forum intend to regulate. In their imagined future, presentation of tokenized credentials will be required to go to work, to school, to the store, to access public buildings and events. Such micromanagement was unfathomable a mere month ago, at least to everyone not in on the scheme. And so when we speak of politics, when we speak of citizens' rights, this is the game changer. Who voted in Common Pass? Who decided individual liberties will now be governed by apps advanced by corporate interests that stand to profit from population control? How relevant will national borders be in an age of real-time geofencing? Past laws have long been used to control targeted populations on Indian reservations, in Nazi Germany, in Palestine, in apartheid South Africa. And now we have CERCO, now we have legal discrimination based on health status. In this global biosecurity state, on any given day, the border could very well end up being your own front door. And so if we don't object, moving forward, blockchain tokens representing all sorts of digital assets, including rights and privileges, will be held in digital accounts. Social entrepreneurs need these biometric identity systems in place in order to install their planned impact economy. Using health status as an issue of national security, our hijacked governments plan to impose this upon us, not for our own good, but because the biocapitalist agenda must proceed. And few realize it, but the COVID drama is providing cover for a far more insidious program of perpetual tracking and tracing tied to health management and Sustainable Development Goal 3. Health data is creating new equity markets, meaning more and more wearable health tech surveillance. The impact management projects practitioners, the asset holders whose greed led to a world beset by chronic illness, have structured new profit centers in Internet of Things preventative care, social determinants of health weaponized. What we are living through is not a public health emergency, but a reset of the global economy managed from Davos on behalf of the finance, technology, and defense sectors. This new normal is totalitarianism wrapped in a shiny green bow. So the post-COVID world will be characterized by a welfare dependency on a scale heretofore unimaginable, justifying the creation of innovative new human capital debt products. Portfolios of people, poor people, will emerge as a new asset class enabled by pay-for-success government contracts. Education, training, healthcare, counseling, nutrition, housing services, all aligned to the UN Sustainable Development Goals to generate the metrics needed to satisfy contractual obligations and financial dealings. The richness of life narrowed to fit the stingy confines of a data analyst's worldview. This is a diagram featuring a digital wallet where food assistance funds are stored on blockchain with coded nudges guiding a recipient's food purchase behaviors. The State of Illinois Blockchain Task Force developed this thought experiment, but similar digital food payment programs are in place managing dispossessed people. The UK company IrisGuard is a major player in this space. Additionally, the NHS has made arrangements to purchase DNA nudge bands tied to COVID testing, regulating food choices. It makes you wonder where the DNA from the testing is going, doesn't it? likely into an academic tech transfer hub. Such is biocapitalism. And so the stakeholder capitalist cannot profitably mine poverty without biometric identification that will be used to aggregate all the interoperable data in smart environments. And vaccine registries will be key to rolling out this program. Gavi is a major player with Gates sitting at the pinnacle of the stakeholder capitalist pyramid. ID 2020 efforts running through United Nations will ensure no one gets left behind, but few are aware that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security bankrolled much of the World Wide Web Consortium's work in the digital identity space. And so as I prepared these remarks today, I couldn't help but mull over the intelligence community's interest in signals intelligence, weaponized narrative, simulation, predictive modeling, and social contagion. How will our collective voices today ripple through this militarized cloud architecture into the general consciousness and beyond? Such are the thoughts that haunt the corners of a Zoom consciousness, Bluffdale and the NSA always out on the horizon, you know. But those of us with eyes to see have the duty to speak. And so I am here today as a mother. I am here as a mapper of geographies of power, as a voracious LinkedIn profile reader and a viewer of obscure government webinars. I'm here as a resident of Philadelphia, a smart city set up for predatory, what works, data-driven government. I'm here to shine light on municipal nudge units funded by self-interested foundations seeking to replace civil servants with apps that manage citizens as agents in behavioral economic equations. I am here as a human relative among a multitude of non-human beings on this beautiful earth that has not yet been remade as a planetary computer for social impact investors. And I am here as a lover of stars who opposes the weaponization of space, the atmosphere, and our weather systems. And I'm here as a voice for peace who views 5G and the planned 6G installations as a domestic military occupation. I'm here to speak of Davos's plans to deny us the opportunity to atone communally for and begin to remedy the devastation capitalism has wrought against nature and indigenous people. And I am here because we have entered a cyborg era in which sociopathic billionaires and defense contractors want to fundamentally alter what it means to be human, tapping nanotechnology and morally bankrupt scientists to do their dirty work. To the wealth hoarders, the masses exist as nodes in the internet of bodies, nodes that must be separated from the cosmic dance through force of law, hydrogel biosensors, and blockchain. Will you own the ledger or will the ledger own you? We are looking at a future where the masses will forfeit their innate human freedoms in exchange for behavioral currency needed to survive within their panopticon. Human capital bonded, each life calculated according to its perceived burden on the coming robot society, at least in the eyes of hedge fund traders as they place their bets. Don't worry, there's safety on the continuum of care pathway. Just do as you're told and keep your social credit score where it needs to be. Every move in every country advancing lots.
That is one very educated consumer. And what she's telling you has all been vetted. It's accurate. Tomorrow, part two, a different person going even further about the Great Reset, who controls it, what it's about, how will it impact us, and how COVID is being used to create a whole new world. In their minds, those in control, like the World Economic Forum head and Davos and the Business Roundtable, nothing will be the same again. You'll be living in their world, under their control, and there will be no room for dissonant voices or even freedom of speech if it in any way does not align with their notions of what should be spoken about. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.